When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Our guest on this episode is a rising star of American letters. Kylie Reid's debut novel, Such a Fun Age, was a Sunday Times and New York Times bestseller when it came out in 2020. Her even more accomplished sophomore novel, Come and Get It, has just come out, and she returned to the podcast to tell Hannah McInnes all about it.
The last time we did this was at the start of our lockdown, online on Zoom. Such a Fun Age had just come out. How are you finding bringing this into the world in real life?
It's a bit different for a number of reasons. I think the first time you do anything, the intensity of it feels so visceral and nerve-wracking. I remember before Such a Fun Age came out, I was so nervous. I was getting like pains in my stomach all the time. And I started taking classes at my gym that I was terrible at, but it helped me get a lot of exercise and adrenaline out. So I did not go back to the gym this time around. I kind of knew what was coming, but I also feel like this is a very different novel. Such a Fun Age had a lot of major set points, and this was a different stylistic book, and it was a different take on money. And so I wanted to do something different, and I knew the reception would be a separate entity. And so far, so great. It's great to hear that readers are still really interested in all of the petty, money, dramatic things that I'm interested in as well. Yeah.
That's okay. You've perfectly summed it up then. Petty, money, dramatic things, did you say?
I do love those things, yes.
And you love talking about them, and this, you know, that is the central theme, and relationships built around money and transaction. But do you feel like you're unique in being able to talk about them? Because I feel like a lot of us still find it very tricky. And even listening in on those conversations through reading is a sort of certain feeling that we have when we talk about money.
I don't feel that I'm unique now that I've been researching these things more. I think Jane Austen talks about money. I think Alice Munro talks about money as well. But money is infiltrating everything. And so it's the angle that you go in at it. I think that what makes my work a bit different is the amount of research I do in terms of dialogue. And so it's an uncomfortable topic. And then I combine that with actual real people talking. And I think that people often feel like they're eavesdropping on my books, which is exactly how I want them to feel. I want my book to kind of fold back in on itself. And so it's a book about gossip and eavesdropping, and that's how the read feels as well. So I'm taking lots of uncomfortable things, I think, and combining them into one.
What is it that you love about the uncomfortable then? There is something, and I've heard you call it, you want readers to be entertained and slightly haunted. And clearly discomfort in your reader is something that you want to provoke a little bit.
You know, it's not just uncomfortability. I'm not a sadist or anything, I promise. For me, the read that I want to have from a novel is a work that taps into the truth of human behavior in a way that like a wormhole kind of forms between the novel and me, where I say, oh my gosh, I've seen that gesture. I've done that thing. That is what that person would do. And it's this deep human connection where I can see something play out in the real world. And that makes me completely forget myself. It's great to see yourself in a novel, but I think it's even better to completely forget everything about your day. And that's what I'm trying to give readers as well.
I mean, you absolutely do that through the dialogue, as you've mentioned, the most authentic dialogue, just taking us into that world. And I want to come back to that, but can you set the scene for those listeners who haven't yet read it? Why did you choose then the University of Arkansas in 2017 as the backdrop for this theme of money and women and the way they talk about it and spend it and the way it sort of impacts their lives?
Yeah, I lived in Fayetteville, Arkansas for exactly a year from 2016 to 17. It is a beautiful place that is really picturesque and I think emblematic of a lot of state school experiences where it's kind of like a little utopia island where around the campus it's incredibly walkable. You can go see your friends and change your major and go lay in a field or go get, you know, a bag of Cheetos with chili in it. And it's very homey and sweet and very easy to live there. So for those reasons, it's nice to go back to a place that you enjoy for a novel because novels take a very long time and you want to be enjoying the place you're at. But in terms of money and consumption, I felt like a dorm was a perfect hothouse, a really claustrophobic space to dive into how people are shaping their personalities around what they consume and the place where you are learning to be an adult sometimes for the first time. I'm really interested in the things people buy and conspicuous consumption and the way that we let our purchases define our personalities. And a dorm seemed like a perfect place to explore that even further.
Because in being interested in money, it's really being interested in what we want, right? What we want for our lives. Mm-hmm. One character wants a home and the security. Others, people would want to travel and think about things very differently. I mean, exploring money is really about exploring what we want and also power big time.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah, all of those things come out of it. And I know when I'm reading a book or watching a movie, I'm constantly like screaming at the screen, like, okay, but how much? Just tell me numbers and cents so I can get a feel of the limitations within the world. But as much as money and consumptions are at the heart of this novel, I have to be honest and say I never start with a theme. It's always about the characters.
Yeah.
And just who these people are and how they interact with each other. And I start very, very granular. And of course, the bigger story comes out later.
And you really do start with the characters. You can tell that because we dive straight in to a scene in which three of the students are being interviewed. And it really is just such a complete picture of character. And so you can tell in your reading that that's hugely important to you. I mean, how do you get to know, are they based on some of the students you interviewed, or how do you get to know your characters so well?
They are not based on them. I will protect my interviewees at all costs. Exactly. I have
character.
To have some journalistic ethics there. For me, I get to know them very slowly. And their purchases were a big part of understanding what they wanted here. So in my classes, we talk about, you know, your surface want and your deeper want. The best example of that is, you know, oh, I want to quit smoking because I want to be healthier. But the deeper one is like, I want my children to have me for longer. And so there's a reason you buy that thing and then what you think that that thing is doing for you and your personality and how you come across people. So for me, interviewing people is a huge part of that process. I wanted to get the language down. I wanted to make sure that these sound like young people in the South. I interviewed from 30 to 40 people, a lot of students, just making sure I had everything right. I did not want to do a satirical take on young people. I think it's a lazy choice to say, oh, look at these dumb kids, especially when I don't believe that they're ignorant in those ways. This was just me wanting to replicate human behavior in all of its forms. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just quickly, you mentioned it's a dorm setting that you felt enabled you to do this. And quite a lot of people have written a campus novel, which I don't think you think it is, or you would say it's not. Why is it important to you that it's the dorm that they're all in, the very close space of the dorm, and not a campus novel?
I don't know about you, but when I think campus novel, I think Ivy League, top of their class, academia, competition within a classroom, big cathedrals. And that's just not the experience of most Americans. That's like 1 or 2%. Most Americans who go to college go to big state schools with, you know, 50,000 people in them and very regular, normal people who are going to have jobs like being a nurse or working at UPS or very normal jobs that you would see in your everyday life. And so I love a campus novel. I just recently reread The Secret History. And it really holds up. But here, this was more about what people are doing in their rooms alone. And I think there's an important distinction there.
Mm. In their rooms alone, there is a loneliness element to a lot of this and what loneliness is, because there's a lot of people around. There's no being alone, but there's a real sense of a loneliness, particularly one of the characters, Kennedy, who's just a tiny bit set apart from the others in her room on her own. She's been through a very difficult experience, which I think I won't give away. But what were you exploring there? Because there's a lot of talk, isn't there, now about an epidemic of loneliness, about young people being very lonely despite being surrounded by others. Was that in the back of your mind?
It definitely was. All right, stay with me here. This is some of the background here. My grandmother, who I was very close to, she died a few years ago. And at her funeral, I talked to her sister, and I knew that she grew up poor, but I didn't know how poor. They had a family of 11 children, and they knew that they could shower or bathe twice a week because there was a natatorium in their neighborhood. And so they knew, like, okay, we can go to the public pool and at least shower twice a week. And they would ask for food at churches and things. It was a really bleak situation for them. I got obsessed with community pools and public pools and went down all these rabbit holes of when, you know, the racial bias started becoming a thing. And I didn't know that public pools were used to inspire hygiene in poor neighborhoods. The history was really fascinating to me. But more than anything, it was really symbolic of a lack of culture and community. We used to have community pools where everyone would go, and that's where you have birthday parties and you fight and you see someone that you used to date and you would have to interact with them in person. And now most people who swim in a pool swim in a private pool in their backyard, and they're not having that one-on-one time with other people and having to reckon with their community. I see a dorm in the same way. You have this great public shared resource, but you are so isolated to your bedroom and you feel like you can't talk to other people. Money comes in there as well, because the way that we use money now is so different than before. If you want money from someone, you Venmo request them, or you just don't never talk about it again and you hold that grudge forever. I think the way that we pay people is very different. And so I was definitely thinking about loneliness in terms of a dorm and a lack of culture and community within a place that's supposed to, you know, serve that function.
And I mean, that character, that Kennedy, also intrigues me because of her relationship with her mother. Mm-hmm. And I've listened to a few interviews you've done, and I've read a few reviews, and I haven't actually seen anyone talk about something that really spoke to me in the book, which is mother and daughter relationships. Yeah. I mean, possibly one of the most complex relationships there is, and how to get the balance right between an impossible closeness and a distance. And I felt that so strongly with Millie and Glory. Yes. You know, she once her mother is ill, they become friends, much against her mother's wish for friendship to be something that right. doesn't come into their relationship. And I just wondered what you were exploring there, that very yeah. difficult balance between how well to get on with your mother as a friend, or what it's yeah. meant to be.
Right. Yeah, you're totally right. Daddy issues get way too much hype. Mommy issues, I think, is where the interesting thing is. Millie, our protagonist, finds herself being very close to her mother when she goes home. She's an only child, and she just finds her mom someone fun to be around. But her mother wants her daughter to have different things than she did, and she kind of pushes that friend title away. And I think Millie is facing the question of how much of my personality is built up around my mother and what she has pushed me to do, pushed me not to do, and am I so responsible because she made me this way? Am I a good sharer and kind of a pushover sometimes because I was an only child? I think it's really interesting when you meet only children who are so, you know, fixated on being a really good sharer because they don't want anyone to think that they're selfish because they're an only child. I think Millie is faced with that a bit. And Kennedy is incredibly close to her mother. And after this really traumatic event, they have to separate for the first time. I think that the book does take us through their closeness, which they love and care for each other so much. But a lot of their relationship is based on, let's go buy this thing. Let's go consume these treats. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of their relationship and closeness is around spending money.
Target.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Target in particular. Have you been to Target?
I don't think I have, but I, you know, it's obviously a huge part of yeah. the novel. And I kept thinking, I haven't been to Target.
It's a pretty powerful place.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah. I can tell. And Millie, is the one, she is, I suppose, a pushover, and it's quite sad. I mean, I felt quite a lot of sympathy or empathy with her. She lets Agatha come into her room to do the eavesdropping, and that's how the fodder for all of Agatha's articles come about that she's writing. But there's a part you write, the feeling of being interested in their lives, it was thrilling and terrible. And you, I mean, you are not Agatha, but no, were you exploring how far a writer can go? Is it thrilling and terrible being a writer? How much of some of people's lives to not plumb, but use and words to use and what your rights are?
I think it's a great question to ask yourself as an artist. Where is the line between using art and life together, and where does exploitation happen? That was something that I definitely was concerned about. I knew in the beginning that I did not want to have too many satirical elements, because I do not want anyone that I interview to make them feel like I'm making fun of them or I'm putting them on a platform for people to shake their hands at. That was incredibly important for me. But it's an interesting question, because Agatha is using the words of people who have not consented, even though she's protecting their identities. But Millie makes these strange, fun new friends, and she takes some of their words and uses them as hers as she's trying to position herself as a cooler, more sophisticated person. I think we're stealing people's words all the time. And for me personally, I do not think for the sake of art that you can exploit someone or that you should. Everyone I interviewed was extremely excited at the idea of something they said showing up in the novel, and so that makes me happy. But all the time, I mean, we listen to pop songs written about people, and we know exactly who those people are, and we just say, oh, okay, that's who that person is, and we don't really know the ins and outs of those things. I'm very obsessed with the gray line of what we take, the intellectual property that we take and use as our own. And I think fiction's a great place to uncover that.
It's so interesting. Yes, you used the word exploitation. I was sitting on the train coming here thinking, what is the word I'm trying to find about the language and the words? And then when exploitation came into my head, I thought, but that is so much a theme of the book, beyond the words, the money, just how far people can exploiting each other.
For sure.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p. With the code HOWTO, just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
I mean, the dialogue, you've mentioned it lots of times, we've talked about it. The conversations you had, how authentic you wanted to keep them. There is a lot of humour in there. It's not that you're gently mocking them, but there is humour in the way they speak. How did you get the balance right again between the authenticity of the language and keeping it prose rather than, I suppose, scripting?
Right. It is a lot of choreography. And I think that the best humor comes actually from people. And so I think that real life people help me find that timing and those rhythms that make things funny. It was such a game. I mean, you're a podcaster, so you know when you transcribe something that it is so messy and there's like lots of ums and likes and oh my gosh, yeah, no. And it was a big game of understanding how much of that to put in, because I want these characters to speak realistically, and how much to take out so it doesn't look like I'm making fun of anyone. So in terms of humor, I think timing is a huge part of that. And it's just trying things over and over and over again until you get to the point where you're like, okay, wait, I think that's a little funny. Yeah.
And do you have in mind this going on? Not this, but when you're writing, do you have in mind that it might go on to be played out either on screen or on stage? Is that something at the back of your mind?
No, I try and keep it like, what is my, the pinnacle is my idea read, you know, and it's, the only thing I can compare it to is I hate when books have a picture of a real person on the cover, because I'm like, no, that's my job to make up what that person looks like. And so when I'm writing a book, I make sure that I am writing just for the book and just for that person's read and giving them enough that they can make up the scenario in their own imagination.
Yeah. And the humor, I should say, for people who haven't read it, I mean, the humor comes surely both for Agatha and for you in the interviews in finding, like, in finding words or ideas that are just so new to her and you. I mean, NARP is like one extraordinary thing.
I did not know that word before students told me that word.
So, I mean, listeners might not know that a NARP is a non-athletic regular person.
That's what it is. Yeah, you and I.
Yes. Which is basically, you know, apparently it's not cruel, but it is kind of cruel. And lots of words like that that sneak in. And there is definitely a humor in a whole new language that have.
Yeah, I think Agatha's hyper-academic take on these words, she knows that that's part of the humor here, that she's someone who is seen as very sophisticated doing an unsophisticated bit of research.
Yeah, I love her sophistication also. She teaches Millie, or Millie has to try to go down at the end rather than go up like all the others do.
Millie is very taken by Agatha and her clothes and the way that she speaks and how she takes notes and everything. And I think that that kind of blinds Millie to the exploitation that's happening. And she does what many people, myself included, do, which is, well, if this person says that it's okay, then it must be okay. I can't see anything wrong happening here.
Can I ask you before I let you go in your busy day about such a fun age? Because you were saying you had stomach aches before you were doing interviews about that at the start. Did the enormous success of that change in any way you wrote? Come and Get It. Did you feel a confidence that you hadn't had before, knowing how well it had done?
God,
or perhaps the pressure.
I wish I felt a confidence. The blank page is the greatest and most humbling, leveling experience I think that any writer has. Any book that you go to again presents all of the same issues of having to work at it over and over again. Such a Fun Age really set me up to take risks and just tell the story that I wanted to tell. Art and commerce are strange things in that I wrote Such a Fun Age from 2014 to 2018 about, and so, and it didn't come out until the beginning of 2020 almost. And so you as a person have changed so much. I couldn't write that book again if I tried. So between the pandemic and becoming a professor and becoming a mother, I was just a different person. I like a little pressure. I like the pressure to produce things that people, I like having things that people know that they can come to me for. I think now people know I'm going to write about dialogue, I'm going to write about money, and there's going to be a lot of women in my books. But as far as the rest of my career goes, I hope to go in different directions every single time. And I hope I feel more adrenaline than pressure. And so far, so good.
Yeah. Confidence might make, you know, you're saying that essentially the blank page being a worrying thing to any writer means you will long be a great writer, because you wouldn't want to be like, well, I've done it before.
Oh, I've got it. Oh, no, I wish.
But the thing I also have loved, I did hear you say that in doing your talks in real life for Such a Fun Age, quite a lot of people came up to you and sort of tried to distance themselves from the character that they were clearly very like. Can you explain that? Because it really made me giggle listening to you talk.
All the time. And listen, I value any read. That is fine. Like, however a book works on you is how it's supposed to work on you. But yeah, for Such a Fun Age, I had so many women, white women, coming to me saying, oh my gosh, Alex, she is the worst. I'm good. I would never do all of these things. And my babysitter actually is part of the family. And it's like, girl, I do not care. I don't care. That is your read. But that is the kind of work that I like to read, though. I love reading books that make me go, ooh, do I do that? I don't know. Is that annoying? And so I hope to put lots more of those moments into my future work.
Yeah, I love it. I just can so see that happening in you, keeping a calm and, you know, polite face just again and again, the same woman. Tell me about the title, because I love you, both of them, very different books, as you've said, very different novels, but you do have a certain type of look, bright, brilliant covers, and inside. I mean, the inside is a work of art in itself, but the Come and Get It, Such a Fun Age, what is it about the kind of grabby title? And I think Come and Get It has a particularly good story.
It does. It was not Come and Get It for so long. I knew in my gut for years that the title was Sui. Woo Pig Sui is the chant of the University of Arkansas. That's what they cheer at all of their games, and it's a big part of the campus culture there. I thought Sui was so violent and place-specific, and it was a calling of people all to one place. No one in the novel is from Fayetteville. Everyone's coming there to get something very different. But no one could understand the word Sui. They would say Shui Zoo. Like, no one could get it. My agent hated it. My editor hated it. And so I said, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. And my agent and I were texting, and she said, okay, but what does Sui mean? It's like, here, pig, come and get it. And there was something there and something really feral about everyone coming. And there was something that screamed money and come and get it. And so I am glad that we landed on that.
But hadn't also you used come and get it as a line on a an internet dating thing or something?
I did. I did.
You don't have to talk.
Oh, I'm happy to. I'm married. It worked. I was on internet dating. I was on Match.com or whatever it is. And they have your name, and they have a little catchphrase that you can have, and mine was, when you're ready, come and get it, na na na, na na na, and it worked.
So it all came around in full circle. You said that you wanted readers to sort of have this certain sense from your books, not to being preached to. It's not important to you that people don't feel there's a message they should take. I mean, we've talked about money, we've talked about transactional relationships, but for you, it's most important that people are entertained. Is that first and foremost? You don't want people there to be some sort of underlying message that someone has to take away.
Oh, yeah. First and foremost, entertainment. I have to write the books that I would want to read. And I hate when people tell me what to think, especially because the things that make me see the world differently are just presenting the world as someone sees it. And that's just what I think a novel is for. Truly, it makes me a little bit sad that we are conditioned to reading books like we're going to write a book report. Like, we need to say, okay, it was about this, and I'm supposed to learn this, and this person was good, and I rooted for the right person, and that's it. I think life is so much more complicated than that. And when I pick up a book, I'm looking for an author to just find truth within our world and just present it to me, almost as if they're showing me data rather than polemics. Mm.
I know that if we were in a live event, someone would ask me your advice. You've done so extraordinarily well, and there are a lot of writers who would just love some Kylie Reid style success. And I know that the bar of Q&A would just say advice.
Advice. Everyone is so different. Everyone writes differently. But these are the things that have helped me: putting your phone away, making serious time to just focus on your writing. A lot of my days that are writing are just me staring at a pen and paper and doodling a bit, just focusing on the world and kind of situating yourself with these characters in a really intimate way. So internet, phone, bad. Try not to do it. That's a big one. Taking your eyes up is a big thing for me. Like, just staring at your computer, I think, does not charge the creative centers of your brain. So having a board that you can post things on, writing things by hand, those are really helpful to me as well. Reading as much as you can, of course. I think this is going to sound very cheesy, but I was in an improv group when I was in college, and I take a lot of the lessons I learned from the improv group into my writing. One of them was, if you make your partner look good, then you'll look good too. And I think about that with my characters. I think that when they behave badly, it's more effective if I show them behaving well in other moments, and showing that they can act like a friendly, warm person. And when they choose not to, it's a bit more heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I also remember from improv classes to call your beat early. And I think about that one all the time. At the tip of a funny scene, at the scariest part, the most tense part, you can pull back a little bit. I think about that when I'm at dinner parties too. You don't want to be the last one to leave. You want to call your beat early in life and in writing.
That's brilliant. You write a lot in cafes, don't you?
I used to. Before the pandemic, I did all the time. But now I'm back in the office, and I still like writing in a gym. Gym is the best place.
God, wow. And are you allowed to tell us what's next?
I'm going to be a little bit coy, I think. I'm always working on something, but I have a little baby daughter, and she's like the big project right now. So the next one will take me a little bit. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Always so lovely.
This episode starred Kylie Reed and was presented by Hannah McInnes. It was produced by me, Vas Christodoulou. Our editor is John Doughty. And I make the show with Nicole Wong. Till next time, thanks for listening.